I'm here with John McCarthy, who is the author of the new book, Working the Wilderness, Early Leaders for Wild Lands, which profiles a number of influential men and women who were instrumental in establishing the wilderness areas in Idaho and shaping the national wilderness ethic in the middle of the 20th century. McCarthy will be at Auntie's Bookstore tonight at 7 p.m. reading from his book, Working the Wilderness, answering questions and talking to folks. And McCarthy himself moved to Idaho in 1977 to work trail crew in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness for the U.S. Forest Service. He later ran a range crew and worked on ranches in Hell's Canyon and Salmon River country. And he started writing about wilderness as a reporter for the Lewiston Morning Tribune, where he also covered cops, courts, arts, and architecture for 10 years. He then switched to environmental organizing and advocacy for 2 decades as the conservation director for the Idaho Conservation League and Idaho Forest campaign director for the Wilderness Society. And now, no stranger to radio, he's a jazz disc jockey at Radio Boise, where he hosts the Beyond the Sky show. John McCarthy, thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me on the air here. It's really fun to be on radio.
Yeah, so your new book is Working the Wilderness, profiles a number of wilderness sort of pioneers in the Forest Service and other forest services in Idaho particularly. And so I thought we'd start first by talking about just the idea of wilderness. So I know it's a long and complicated journey, but can you give us sort of the Cliff Notes version of what is a designated wilderness area and how did that come to be a thing in the United States?
Well, early in the 20th century, there was a set of folks in the Forest Service primarily, but also people who just really appreciated wildlands, looked at the legacy of what John Muir was trying to do with national parks and said they thought they needed to do something different, where the idea was really to protect the land itself. And human use was secondary, and do it before the land was gone and before it was all chopped up, and to do it when there were still big blocks of land. It took 8 years from the time they first wrote the Wilderness Act to by the time in 1964 it was finally passed. But the whole idea during that time of negotiations and compromises was to create something that came as close to America's past as was possible. There's compromises made for airplanes, and in Idaho's case later on, even for jet boats. But the idea was to go back to the 19th century, to go back to the 1800s and look at how that land held up through the 20th century and how to protect it as close as possible to its natural state. And with that in mind, when the act was passed in 1964, people had to look at what really fit and what didn't fit, mm-hmm. and what was there on the landscape, like cabins, like trails, like bridges, like lookouts, that fit and what didn't fit, and what was historic and what was just sort of cobbled together at the time. And so the folks that I write about were there, a couple of them were there in the 50s, in the 60s, but the bulk of them were, it really starts in 1964 with the mm-hmm. Wilderness Act. The Selway Bitterroot was one of the original wildernesses, as was, like, say, Glacier Peak here in Washington. So there was not that many. It was less than 10 million acres were set aside at first. But those lands were very, very special to the people who lived in the area and to the nation. And the whole idea was, to how do you protect it? How do you preserve it? And these people that I write about played direct roles in shaping that concept of what do we do with wilderness now that we've declared it, and how does that fit in for future wilderness? Now the wilderness system is 100 million acres.
Yeah. And so you profile a handful of people in the book, the first of whom are Emil and Penny Keck, who you mentioned the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, one of the first wilderness areas set up in 1964, and they were already there. So tell us about the Kecks. Introduce us to them.
Well, the very first day I got to this place called Moose Creek Ranger Station in the middle of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, Emil and Penny walked up from the bridge site that they were working on, and they were my bosses on trail crew, but they also built bridges, rebuilt bridges. They built the bridges that were built in the early part of the 20th century, rebuilt perhaps in the 50s, and then in the 60s, 70s, 80s, they rebuilt them again, or maybe they built them, rebuilt them for the second time. And that meant they tore apart almost all the wood and replaced it, and they refurbished the metal. And so these people,
all by hand, yeah,
and just the two of them,
yeah,
no crew. I mean, they used, they helicoptered in some materials, they airdropped some materials from moving airplanes, they threw things out the doors,
but no power tools.
They used some power tools on the bridge sites, like on the biggest bridge that they were working and happened to be working on at the time I was there, the Three Links Bridge that crosses the Selway River. It has a 252-foot railing with thousands of drill holes, and they used a powered drill to do all the drill holes rather than a brace and bit. So they did use some power tools, but they used the power tools in the winter when they were the only people out there. They were the only people who lived there all year round. Emil was originally the fire control officer, but then they split that job off, and he became the maintenance guy for all the trails and for all the bridges, and also the trainers for everybody, the wilderness rangers, the fire crews, for everybody to learn how to use tools and to learn how to get around in the wilderness. So they knew all the trails, they knew where all the springs were, they knew where all the hard stream crossings were, they knew all of the landscape. And they knew young people because they both had trained to be coaches. Hmm. They both went to college, and neither of them finished, but they both went to college to train to be a coach. And then they just sort of got swept out into the wilderness and stayed there because of their skills. But the thing that really stuck with me when I went back to think about who were all these people and what were their qualities, the qualities that the Kecks had that was just so strong, was that they were teachers. They were coaches. They took these young punks like me from all over the country who just had an interest in being out there, being in the land. They didn't, you know, none of us really knew what we were doing. We weren't farm kids. We weren't, most of us, you know, we didn't come from logging backgrounds like Emil did, like a farm kid like Penny. Most of us were just, you know, this was the 70s. This was the 80s. This is when kids just wanted to go back to the land. People wanted to, you know, explore their vision. And they took kids like that, like us, and created us into really skilled trail crew, packers, lookouts, you know. So we were part of a history, a part of a Forest Service history, part of an American history. And that's a big part of what wilderness is to connect us to our history, to the whole sense of the American legacy.
Yeah. I'm talking with John McCarthy, the author of Working the Wilderness, Early Leaders for Wildlands, and we've been talking about Emil and Penny Keck, two pioneers in the Forest Service in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. So before we get too much farther, I'm going to ask you to read a section from the book, and this comes from the section specifically about Emil and Penny Keck.
Okay, this is a part... they've both been introduced, but now I'm talking about the chapter's called, it's chapter three, it's called Builders of Bridges, and I'm going to talk about one of their bridge sites. When Emil and Penny worked at both the Three Links and Bear Creek bridge sites, they set up a base camp to stay for months that led to years living out of a 10x20 canvas wall tent, same as the first construction camps in the backcountry. A scrap of plywood nailed to a stump made a table. Bolts of wood set on end made stools. Canvas mantis laid over the dirt formed a floor. Panniers and old powder boxes became shelves. Most food was freeze-dried, dry goods or canned, all cooked on a wood stove. A hole dug into the floor and lined with boughs created a root cellar with a plywood cap. The cool storage not only kept cans from freezing, they layered in fruits, cabbages, and root vegetables. A Coleman lantern hung from the ridgepole for light on the long winter nights and early mornings. They packed in a metal bed frame to Three Links to sleep off the ground above the rattlesnakes, a crackly transistor radio to listen to baseball games, with number 9 wire running up into the trees for an antenna, offered the only thing in the tent that resembled a luxury and the only connection with the outside world. The key to winter camp comfort was a Kimball wood stove, deceptive in its simplicity. The bottomless stove sat directly on the sand with space cut out from the canvas floor. A double layer of sheet plastic formed an envelope that encircled both the floor over the peak of the roof. The plastic shed rain and slicked off snow off from the roof while trapping the warmth from the stove. As Emil explained, the box stove warmed the sand floor, so pretty quick it gets so goddamn hot you could walk around barefoot when it's 40 below if you wanted to. That sure was a nice way to live. So when anyone felt sorry for us for staying in a goddamn winter camp, we're as warm as can be.
That was my guest, John McCarthy, reading from his book, Working the Wilderness, Early Leaders in Wildlands. And he'll be at Auntie's Bookstore tonight, 7 p.m., reading more from the book and answering questions and signing copies, 7 p.m. at Auntie's Bookstore. So,
can I add just one thing?
Yeah, of course.
When the final edit was done, goddamn, and I mean, I can't help but say that I sang this on the radio, and I felt a little funny about saying it on the radio, but that's just the way he talked. So in the final edit, there were so many places where I already had it lowercase, because I didn't want to make it too saccharine. It was just, it had to be made into one word. And it just happened over and over, and I hadn't really thought about how that's just almost a sentence didn't go by when he couldn't curse. And fortunately, my publisher said it was okay. That's just the way he talked. That's who he was.
Yeah, and you do such a great job of capturing the character of these people. I think profiles of anyone who dedicates their lives to a particular thing are always really interesting. But somebody who dedicates their life to living in a really isolated way in the wilderness just for the purpose of essentially improving it for other people and preserving it for future generations. It's a fascinating group of people to get to learn about in this book.
Cool. Cool.
And so after the Keks, which take up about, the first third or so of the book, you go into a couple more people. So after the Keks, there's two men who, in addition to getting their hands dirty and working in the wilderness, were really involved in policy and sort of defining what wilderness was and how it was managed. So Bud Moore, who was really influential in developing fire management practices in particular, and William Wharf, who was a lifelong proponent of wilderness and one of the founders of the advocacy group Wilderness Watch, among many other things. So you want to just introduce us to those two men?
Yeah, Bud was an extraordinary character. Both of them are extraordinary in that they were skilled on the ground, but then could influence how the whole agency worked. And the Forest Service was a giant bureaucracy.
Which the
at the
PECs,
time,
we should say, were not that way.
No, they didn't. They weren't diplomats, and they didn't do paper, and they didn't do meetings. I mean, you couldn't get Emil to go to a meeting. Penny later on had to go to meetings, but you couldn't get Emil to go to a meeting anywhere. He just worked, and that's what he did. But Bud did both, and Bud grew up on the east side of the Selway Bitterroot in Lolo, on Lolo Creek in Montana, and was the bridge between the old mountain men and the new mountain men. He was a trapper as a young teenager. He herded sheep in the Locksaw as a young teenager. He was on a fire lookout.
13 years old,
he was out herding sheep by himself in the wilderness. 14 years old, he was running a trap line in the winter by himself. He quit school at eighth grade. He became a fire lookout at age 17 in 1935 and worked his way up to be a district ranger, which was a big deal in those days. I mean, still a big deal, but district ranger was like one of the top jobs in the Forest Service. Then he went to D.C., came back and ran the whole fire program for Region 1, which is all of northern Idaho and all of Montana. And came back, and all of his time being out in the wilderness, looking at the landscape and understanding how it works for animals and water and everything else, he said, if we're going to have wilderness, we're going to have fire back on the landscape on purpose. And remember that the Forest Service was really got strength after the 1910 fire that burnt through here, burnt through all of northern Idaho into Montana.
The big burn.
The big burn. And the idea was that they had to put out all fires. That was the Forest Service job. There was no discretion as to how or where or when. You had to just do it. And he came back to Montana after in Idaho after being in D.C. in the 60s and in the early 70s, before anybody else pulled it off. He said, we're going to study how we can bring back fire in a way that mimics nature but doesn't threaten people, or, you know, moves people, forces people to adjust, but doesn't, we don't lose life, and we try and minimize the loss of property.
Not whole towns being burned.
Not whole towns. Yeah. And so that the fire is managed, not controlled to always be suppressed. And, I, you know, as I thought about Bud, it was because he was a mountain man, because he had these skills, but he also understood the bureaucracy. And so he created a study process. He got top quality young scientists who are out in the field, who evaluated the landscape. 1972, he got it approved. It wasn't much of a fire year. 1973, they had their first fire. And the very first fire that was intentionally managed in the whole country was in the Selway Bitterroot because of Bud Moore. I don't think anybody else had the juice, had the power, had the respect within the agency to pull it off. And he went on to do many other things in his life, but he also was a mentor, a teacher for so many people, whether it was teaching people, he trapped animals for their pelts, but he taught people how to trap animals as part of studies, which is of course another value of wilderness, where wilderness is the natural place to be able to study what's nature like without human manipulation. So Bud continued to do great things in his life, and I met him after he'd retired from the Forest Service, but people had been telling me about him for years. So, and Bill Worf, similar person, where within the agency he was a leader for really appreciating that wilderness was different than recreation. Even though his specialty was recreation as a horse guy, as a packer, as somebody who grew up in a ranch in Montana, his interest was in recreation and in horses. He understood that protecting the land was different than recreation, and that the landscape needed to be as natural as possible with as little intrusion as possible. And he brought those values to the Forest Service, that it's not about doing it fast and cheap and easy. It's about doing it right and doing it in a way that protects the land, not is easier for people. He carried that on in the organization he created, Wilderness Watch, and that organization continues today. Many people think they're purists, and they have a sense of that, you know, the wilderness is really about excluding people. That wasn't Bill's attitude, and Bill thought of himself as a practical person who the wilderness had a real purpose, and let's respect the wilderness as a resource.
Well, that brings up a good point, which is a major theme in this book, is the idea of wilderness means very different things to different people. And that's been a constant push and pull since before the Wilderness Act, but particularly afterwards, when they were like, okay, we called these things wilderness, now what does that mean? And you, like you said, does that mean excluding people? Does that mean excluding specific tools, numbers of people, how you can access it and what you can do in those areas? And that was a constant struggle among all of these people and the various users as well.
And it continues to be a struggle today. And that was certainly one of my intents, was to try and show that people like Worf and Bud Moore had consistent ideas, and they wanted consistency, and they wanted people to follow similar plans, not maybe exact kinds of ideas. But Worf in particular was all about creating something that could be, wasn't one way in one place and a different way in another place, and that leads to things being watered down and diminished so that it's the easiest way.
Yeah.
He wanted people to understand that the crosscut saw and the axe were the way to go, and it wasn't just for quiet, and it wasn't just because chainsaws make a lot of noise. It's just the intrusion of mechanics was his idea to try and limit. And brings up the last
individual. Yeah, I was going to say that leads perfectly to the last person, who was Warren Miller, sort of a champion of the crosscut saw, among other things.
And he was much more my contemporary. He was a kid out of California and sort of just landed in the wilderness, but he had a degree in physics. He had a scientific mind. He was a very precise person. And he was the one who figured out how to really refurbish, resharpen, make a crosscut saw really work. And it's a fine piece. A good crosscut saw is a fine tool, fine piece of equipment. It can cut through logs just fine if you know how to use it and if it's in a good shape. And he knew how to put them into shape, and he knew how to teach people how to do it. So he was this guy who landed in the wilderness when he was in his 20s in 1970 and didn't really have a vision for his life. And he ended up working in the service of crosscut saws and in the service of people in the wilderness for the rest of his life.
I've been talking with John McCarthy, the author of Working the Wilderness, Early Leaders for Wildlands, a new book just been published this year. And he will be here in Spokane at Auntie's Bookstore tonight at 7 p.m. reading from the book, answering questions, talking more in depth about all of these fascinating people who dedicated their lives to wilderness and public lands. So, John McCarthy, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's really been nice.